wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello, Ellen.
Hello, Millie. Hello, Beth.
Hello, everybody.
I'm excited.
I am very excited.
I'm excited because Wiseblood are playing the Power Station on the 29th of May.
Are you a Wiseblood fan?
Oh, hell yes.
Oh,
oh, okay. It's going to be so good.
It's going to be beautiful.
I only just found out, so I'm excited. Anyway, onto the science.
Onto the science. Now, you've got some very, very fun topics for us today.
Oh, like I normally don't, I mean.
No. Always fun here.
No, it's something a little bit different today, I thought, because sort of trolling through the literature and trying to find stories, and what I did find out was that today in 1966, a guy by the name of James M. Schlatter filed for a patent for a sweetening agent that he had accidentally made in the laboratory. And that we currently know as NutraSweet, which I'm sure probably many of the listeners would know. Is that a common thing?
Yeah.
And the whole thing was an accidental discovery, and so I thought we would contribute accidental discoveries in science today.
Dear Science, where accidents happen.
Absolutely. And just how many of these great scientific discoveries turn out to be sort of completely accidental, really. So let's start by talking about this guy, James M. Schlatter. And in 1965, he was beavering away in the lab, as you do. And way back in those days, health and safety wasn't taken as seriously as it is today. So when we're in the chemistry lab these days, you're all gloved up and everything. You've got your PPE
on. Got your fume hood on.
Absolutely, yes. Things were very, very, very different back in those days. So anyway, he was busy doing some work. And what he was trying to do was to make an anti-ulcer drug. So he was playing around this, that and everything. And he wanted to pick up a piece of paper that was on his bench. So, as you do, he licked his fingers and went to pick up the piece of paper. And he noticed that his fingers tasted sweet. Because he'd managed to spill something on the outside of the flask that he was using. And he thought, oh, that's interesting. And lo and behold, he had invented NutraSweet. And this was a very lucrative discovery for him and for his company, because this was 200 times sweeter than sugar. And remember, last time we were talking about sort of how we taste and how we smell, you know, and all this thing about, you know, shapes of molecules and stuff like that, and how they give particular signals to the brain and everything, and that's how we smell. And again, taste is kind of similar. But these molecules look nothing like sugar. All the ones that we're going to be sort of talking about, you know, they're shape-wise, they just don't look like sugar at all. You wouldn't pick them as being sweet, but in fact they were. So that was 1965. So let's go all the way back to the first artificial sweetener. And those of you listening with very, very long memories might remember a molecule called saccharin.
Yes, I actually studied that.
Okay. So tell us all about it then.
Well, it was the first artificial sweetener.
It absolutely was. And this was in the 19th century, in fact. So this was 1897. This was discovered, invented, and again, purely serendipitous.
That's amazing.
Because, again, a researcher busy beavering away in the lab forgot to wash his hands, okay, and then was probably out having lunch or something like that, and again, accidentally licked his fingers or whatever and found something sweet. So that was interesting to them, but he didn't know what the sweet stuff was. So apparently the story goes, he went around tasting everything in the lab to try and figure out which was this particular. Yeah, exactly.
How is he not dead?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, back in the day, that was what you used to do. That a lot of people would actually taste the things that they made, you know.
Well, I mean, there was arsenic in makeup.
Yes.
Uranium in the glass.
Yep, I mean, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. And so, you know, fortunately he survived. And found out that, yes, this stuff is very, very sweet. And what it was it's the chemical name benzoic sulfamide, okay? And That was a derivative of coal tar, which was sort of pitch, sort of asphalt, all that, you know, all that nasty sort of stuff that comes as byproducts of this, that, and the other thing of oil distilling and blah, 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 blah. And so that was, again, very valuable for the company, and the company that sold that was a little company called Monsanto, which I'm sure you've all heard of. And so they basically got their start in 1901 selling saccharin. So, and saccharin, 300 times sweeter than sugar. Okay, so again, another accidental discovery of a sweetener. Then we fast forward to 1937, and a thing called Cyclamate. And again, so this was a grad student at the University of Illinois. So this would be a PhD student or a master's student. Again, playing around in the lab, went for a ciggy.
Oh, no.
Went for a ciggy, didn't wash his hands. And again, got the old, you know, finger taste. Oh, that's sweet. So, you know, in these days of health and safety, these discoveries might never have been made.
I know. Isn't that amazing? As a chemist, it does make my skin crawl. So the number one rule is no smelling, no tasting.
Yes. But so this stuff was 30 to 50 times sweeter than sugar. And this was widely, widely used. And I think this was used in things like Tab and Diet Pepsi, apparently, until the late 1960s. When they found it caused bladder cancer in rats. And so the FDA jumped on this and said, no, we can't be having that. And apparently that ban still is in force today. So, again, they would have made a lot of money off it probably quickly, but then the lawsuits probably started flooding in, as seems to be the case in the States, which then leads us to 1976 and sucralose.
Oh, okay? No.
And that's one that's very, very common today. Okay, so chances are if you're drinking an artificial sweetener, then sucralose may well be the stuff. And in this case, they were using molecules that actually did look very, very similar to sugar.
Right.
And what they were trying to do was put chlorine on them. And that's just about the last thing you would do if you wanted to, A, make something that you could actually eat, or B, make something that was sweet. And, of course, they, you know, they got lucky. And apparently, again, so the story goes, the student who made it was told to test the compound.
Oh, gosh.
He misheard it as taste the compound. Luckily, he survived. And again, you know, found that this stuff was awfully, awfully, awfully sweet. And again, 600 times sweeter than sugar. Now, the beauty about sucralose is because it's got these chlorines in it and because it looks like sugar, it's actually very, very stable. So your other ones, your aspartames and your saccharins and stuff like that, you can't really use them in cooking because heat destroys the compound, okay? So... But sucralose is all good like that. You can quite happily bake your finest, sweetest bickies or pastries or cakes or whatever.
And it will hold its structure.
It will absolutely hold its structure and it will stay sweet. So those are four examples of serendipity in science. Just, you know, complete dumb luck, really.
There you go.
But and they're all of the same thing, which is the weird thing. Artificial sweeteners, you know, that people just got lucky by licking their fingers, which to me seems weird.
It is bringing a bit of clarity because I feel like there's always been so much controversy around an artificial sweetener.
Yes, yep.
Everyone hates them for some reason.
Well, again, there's the health. Not benefits. What's the opposite of benefits? But the health problems of sugar itself, of sucrose, are very, very well known. You know, so it's not an inert sweetener itself. You know, we know that obviously too much of the stuff is bad for you, and so obviously, quite rightly, what companies have done is to try and make alternatives to this that aren't bad for you. And can't be metabolized. That's the whole point, is that, you know, one of the problems with sugar is it gets metabolized, you release energy, and so therefore, you know, that's not good because you've got all this energy in the body you've got to get rid of.
Yeah.
Whereas these artificial sweeteners, with the exception of sucralose, which is metabolized a little bit by the body, the other ones just essentially go straight through. So, you know, you're not getting the so-called calories, or should we say kilojoules, because we're SI. From those, okay.
Is that why excessive consumption leads to a laxative effect?
It could well be, actually. Yeah. I don't know enough about laxatives to answer that one way or the other, but it sounds sensible. Yeah.
You read the back of a packet of sugar-free sweets and they're like, no, not too many. You will pay.
So those are four sort of, I think, interesting examples of serendipity. Here are another few. And we'll see how much time we've got to go with. But number one, Teflon. Okay, so we all know about Teflon and how cool it is that you can have these nice non-stick everythings. And your, you know, your fried eggs don't stick, your bacon doesn't, you know, all that good stuff. Amazing. So how did Teflon come along? So 1938, guy by the name of Roy J. Plunkett, again, a lab worker. And he had a cylinder of a gas called tetrafluoroethylene. And what he was involved in was study for making refrigerants. And he was involved in these molecules called chlorofluorocarbons, which were very good refrigerants in the day, but now we know that they kill the ozone hole.
Yeah, it's so bad. Well,
they make the ozone hole, sorry. So they're not the best for you, but way back in the 30s they didn't know this. And he had a cylinder of this stuff, which was probably quite expensive, and he opened up the tap to do some work with it, and nothing came out. And he thought, oh, no, that can't be right. I know it's not empty. I've only used, I think it was 9/10 of it, so there should be some left. And he couldn't figure out why there was none left. So in something that would be seen as being totally freaking idiotic today, he decided to cut open the cylinder and see what the hell was going on. The last thing you do is, well, like literally the last thing you do is try and saw open a gas cylinder.
Pierce a gas cylinder.
Yeah. But he did. And what he found was this white powder in there. And what had happened was that the tetrafluoroethylene had polymerized. It was a gas. It had turned into this white solid called polytetrafluoroethylene. Ooh. And if you get an acronym from that, it's Teflon. Polytetrafluoroethylene. Teflon. That's where we get Teflon from. And he sort of realized that it was pretty cool stuff fairly quickly, but in fact it wasn't until about the mid-50s that it was commercialized as a non-stick agent in pots and pans and stuff, and you know, all of those applications that we now know today. So again, purely serendipitous, and very, very cool.
What a good accident. We still use Teflon, don't we?
We do. Now, people, you know, there are concerns about these so-called forever chemicals, which are fluorinated, polyfluorinated things like Teflon. I don't like that word, forever chemicals. But it's pejorative. Water is a forever chemical, for goodness sake.
Yeah, okay.
You know. So let's not go there. Let's get on to radioactivity. The second last accidental one that we're going to be talking about today.
Another whoops.
Exactly, another whoops. So, Henri Becquerel, Frenchman, and he was playing around with stuff at the end of the 19th century. And he was interested in uranium salts. Okay, you mentioned uranium before in glass. Yep, absolutely. Okay, so one of the reasons why it looks good in glass is that it phosphoresces. Okay, so essentially it gives out light.
It's gorgeous.
Oh, absolutely.
Uranium glass is really pretty.
Yeah. And this is one of the features of so-called uranium, of some uranium salts anyway, is that given the right circumstances, they can fluoresce, they can give off light. And he was really interested in this, and he sort of wanted to know why these things gave off light. And he figured that what was happening was that they were absorbing sunlight, and then somehow they were storing that, and then at a later time they were emitting the light, okay? And that's the way that some phosphorescent things actually do work, that you expose them to light and then you take the light source away and they continue glowing. But uranium salts don't do that. And what he was doing was putting them next to photographic plates to see if he could capture the image of the uranium salts while they were giving out the light. And then one day in Paris in late February 1896, I think it was a cloudy weekend.
Oh.
It was a cloudy day, and he thought, oh, bugger it, I'm not going to be able to do my experiment because there's no sunlight out there. And so he put his uranium salts on top of a photographic plate that hadn't been exposed, and he put them in a drawer for the weekend. And he came back on the Monday, and of course it's dark in the drawer, and he thought, oh, bugger it, I'll expose this plate, see what's happened. And lo and behold, beautiful sharp image of these salts. And so obviously it couldn't have been the light. And he had lucked out and discovered essentially radiation. Okay.
Is that the X-ray?
No, the X-ray is something different. The X-ray was discovered the year before.
Is that Marie Curie, the X-ray?
No, it was Wilhelm Röntgen. Okay? But Marie Curie was one of the first to discuss and sort of figure out what radioactivity was all about. Mm. So she ended up getting the Nobel Prize for that, as did Rutherford.
Okay, oh, so it was
They both got... Oh, no, he got it as well. Don't panic.
I felt really hurt for him, actually.
No. So, again, purely serendipitous. And, again, as somebody said, chance favours the prepared mind.
It sure does.
So if he hadn't bothered to develop that photographic plate, then he probably would have missed it.
Maybe we were being late to the radioactivity yes, bus.
Yep. Who knows? Mm. So, and the last one that we're going to talk about is one that everybody knows, penicillin.
Yeah.
Good old penicillin.
Good
and
stuff.
Apparently, so everyone knows the story of Alexander Fleming, but apparently he was a bit messy in the laboratory. Apparently. A bit messy. And so he went off on his summer holiday and he left a few of his sort of agar plates and stuff and his petri dishes sort of just floating around the lab, blah, 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 blah. And he got back apparently in September and he found that this mold had started growing on some of his plates. Mm. And these agar plates had Staphylococcus on them, okay? So a nasty bacterium. And what he then noticed was, you know, just from this accidental infection by this mold, you have a look at the plates and he found that the Staphylococcus wasn't growing in the region where the mold was. So there was something in the mold that was stopping the replication of this bacteria. And lo and behold, or this bacterium, sorry, singular. And so lo and behold, he discovered the world's first antibiotic.
Yeah.
And for which humanity is extraordinarily grateful. And but then the thing didn't stop there, or it really didn't start there where it should have, because obviously he recognized the importance of this, but getting amounts of the bacterium, of the antibiotic, of the penicillin, was a hell of a job.
Really?
And the people who actually did that were an Australian guy by the name of Florey, and a German-Jewish emigre by the name of Chain. And they figured out how to get enough of this stuff in order to be be actually useful. And all three of them ended up getting the Nobel Prize for this, you know, remarkable discovery. But again, purely accidentally, just sort of wandered off for a summer holiday, came back, and shit, there's the Nobel Prize on your desk, you know. I mean,
so that's a note for all our listeners at home. Those plates in your room, don't worry about them. Just let them go mouldy.
Whatever growing on them, that you know, it could change the world. You never know.
Well, that was most marvellous. Accidents happen, and sometimes they'll get you a Nobel Prize.
Indeed, they will.
Well, thank you, Ellen, and thank you, Motat. And thank you, science, for being great.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.